Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. Dr. Trullier began and ended his message this morning with the theme of the resurrection, of the great hope of resurrection. And the most moving painting that I have seen of the resurrection is that by the Latin American artist Adolfo Perez Esquivel. The empty tomb stands in the foreground to a dismal contemporary scene. There are scenes of war and famine, of environmental degradation and slavery and so on in the background. And the risen Christ stands in front of the empty tomb, and he is surrounded by a group of people. You recognize urchins from the streets of Latin American cities who have disappeared while in police custody. There are native peoples massacred by conquistadors and transnational logging companies. You recognize the face of Oscar Romero, the Salvadorian archbishop, who was murdered in 1980 by right-wing death squads. You recognize the environmental activist Chico Mendes, also murdered. There are two American Catholic nuns who were raped and murdered by General Pinochet's army in Chile. And you recognize other victims of torture and oppression there gathered around the risen Christ. It's only in the light of the resurrection that we are able to affirm every act of love and justice, every word of truth spoken in the face of lies, and every work of beauty in a world of ugliness. It's only in the light of the resurrection that we can dare to affirm that history, our history, has ultimate significance. And as Dietrich Bonhoeffer famously observed from his prison cell, Tintagel Prison, the difference between the Christian hope of resurrection and a mythological hope is that the Christian hope sends a man back to his life on earth in a wholly new way. And that is what our brother has been expounding for us this morning. The sociologist Zygmunt Bauman has described our postmodern condition in terms of two metaphors, the metaphor of the vagabond and the metaphor of the tourist. Both the vagabond and the tourist express lifestyles of non-attachment. The vagabond sets his destination even as he goes, and what keeps him on the move is disillusionment with the last place in which he stayed and the hope that maybe the next place or the place after that will give him the temporary satisfaction that he is seeking. And like the vagabond, the tourist is moving through other people's territory. He has no commitment to that territory or to its people. Indeed, the freedom that he has paid for is a freedom to be unaffected, to be unmoved by what is happening around him. The moment there is any trouble, he can take the next plane home. So for the tourist, the world is to be experienced purely aesthetically, the world as pleasure. So neither the vagabond nor the tourist feels any moral obligation to the spaces that they inhabit. But Dr. Trullier has reminded us again this morning that we as Christians are neither vagabonds nor tourists, but we are resident exiles. And as resident exiles, we are committed to the places in which we live. For this world, in spite of all its evil and corruption, still has a future. And the church does not philosophize about that future world. The church demonstrates the working of the coming kingdom within this world. The church's being is in mission. Mission is what defines the church. The church is a missionary community. And the redemption of culture has always been central to the church's mission. There are many cultures and marginalized people who would have simply disappeared off the face of history if not for the painstaking work of Christian missionaries. This is not something that is often mentioned in the secular academy. But there were many Christian missionaries down the ages who have defended native interests against colonial domination, both the colonialism of the European powers, but also of the dominant indigenous cultures. And more significantly, perhaps, missionaries were often the first to write down local grammars and dictionaries, bringing literacy or a vernacular literary renewal. Think even of modern Europe, the impact of Tyndale's English translation of the Bible on the development of the English language and English literature, or of Luther's German translation and what it did for German culture. You think of William Carey and the Bengali Renaissance. Rabindranath Tagore called Carey the father of the Bengali Renaissance. Now, Carey was simply a cobbler, a shoemaker, without a university education, but who ended up as the first professor of Sanskrit at Serampore College. And the act of translating the New Testament and also the classics of Indian literature into vernacular Bengali led to a revival of Bengali culture. When Robert Morrison set sail for China in 1807, the entire Chinese resources of British universities consisted in one manuscript in the British Museum library. But from the London Missionary Society alone came four professors of Chinese for British universities. They founded chairs in Chinese in British universities. And of those four, three did not even have a university education. You see, their missionary engagement bred in them certain scholarly habits, certain scholarly instincts, a profound gospel engagement with an alien, even hostile society, generates new forms of scholarship, new academic disciplines. The disciplines like linguistics and social anthropology, public health, would not be there in our universities if not for the work of Christian missionaries. And that's a story that the modern secular academy has either forgotten or deliberately suppressed. So notice that these great missionary scholars didn't spend their lifetime just accumulating knowledge and degrees and then thinking, now, how can we apply our scholarship to the world out there? But rather, they first were engaged with the world out of their conviction of the truth of the gospel. And out of that missionary engagement, they became scholars. And in turn, that scholarship fed into the mission of the church. It was also the missionary imperative that compelled the church to take the conversion of the Roman Empire seriously and to seize the opportunities that that afforded. These are not merely opportunities for Christians to exercise power. They were not on some power trip, but they were opportunities to curb the violence and the cruelty of the state, and also to forgive their former persecutors. As Oliver O'Donovan has observed, in each generation, Christians have turned a critical eye on the most severe measures of justice deployed by their society and asked how they might be mercifully restrained. And that's why the best Christian political thought has always emphasized the need to set up restraints in two directions. The state bears the sword of God. It's called to act as a restraint against evil. But the evil with which we restrain evil also needs to be restrained. Original sin means that the enemy is within us, as Dr. Trulia observed, as well as in the perpetrator that we confront. And this is why we need the practice both of a tough-minded realist politics, founded on the possibility of force, but also of a just politics founded on disciplines that constrain force to the service of the common good. Now, my friends, you belong to a great nation. As Dr. Trulia has been saying, the new Babylon of our age. There is no rival to America in the world. America is the greatest economic power the world has ever seen. America is the greatest military power the world has ever seen. 40% of all military expenditure in the world takes place within this nation. It's a great nation. But with that great power comes great responsibility. And what does it mean then for you as Christians to be engaged not only with American culture in a missionary way, but also with American government, with the state in a missionary way? Is it not to remind the state of its global responsibility? No international collective action on the planet can ever be effected without the support, or at least the consent, of the United States government. And yet, tragically, as you well know, in the last decade, the U.S. has been the one government that has sabotaged almost every international agreement, from the Kyoto Protocol to treaties to limit the spread of anti-personnel landmines, to curb the spread of small arms, the updating of the 1972 Convention on Biological and Toxic Weapons, the setting up of an international criminal court to try people guilty of acts of genocide and crimes against humanity. The great legacy of Christendom, my friends, was the legacy of international law. To say that the state is answerable to a law that is not of its own creation. That is what it means to bring politics under the rule of Christ. And as a Christian church, we have a responsibility to remind the powers that be that Christ has conquered, that Christ is victorious. And the practical outworking of that is to submit to a law that is greater than the laws that we enact. So this demands a sense of global accountability and responsibility. In 1994, Rwanda, a country of just 8 million people, experienced the numerical equivalent of more than 2 World Trade Center attacks every single day for 100 days. On an American scale, this would mean 23 million people murdered in 3 months. Now, when on September 12, 2001, the United States turned to the world and asked its friends around the world for support, the world responded with an overwhelming outburst of sympathy and practical support. But when the Tutsis cried out, the world turned away. In fact, it could be argued that the Hutu would have been restrained in their massacres if the United Nations peacekeeping force had remained in Rwanda. But it was because of pressure from the then US President and the British Prime Minister, John Major, that the UN decided not to intervene. Let me close with 2 quotations from 2 leading historians. Professor Paul Kennedy, who teaches modern history at Yale University, in an article in the Washington Post in March this year, writes, "There is a deep yearning abroad these days for America to show real leadership. Not what Senator William Fulbright once termed the arrogance of power, but leadership of the sort best exemplified by Roosevelt. It would be a leadership marked by a breadth of vision, an appreciation of our common humanity, a knowledge that we have as much to learn from others as we have to impart to them. It would be a leadership that spoke to the disadvantaged and weak everywhere, and that committed America to join other advantaged and strong nations in a common endeavor to help themselves. Above all, it would be a leadership that turned openly to the American people and explained time and again why our deepest national interest lies in taking the fate of our planet seriously and in investing heavily in its future." The second quotation is from the late Professor A.J.P. Taylor in his book, The Troublemakers. He writes, "Conformity may give you a quiet life. It may even bring you a university chair. But all change in history, all advance comes from the nonconformists. If there had been no troublemakers, no dissenters, we should still be living in caves."